call the Judiciary Committee meeting together. The Judiciary Committee meeting, what is this, the first day of March, isn't it? First of March, we're at 1:35. In order the way we're going to do business today, we're going to bring up Senate Bill 43. We have an amendment. That's the discussion on the property crimes issue. There's an amendment on the table. We'll deal with that. And then we will go from there to Senate Bill 22. We have a whole slew of amendments and some public testimony. Was there any, Secretary, is there anybody interested in testifying on Senate Bill 43 at this point?
No, not 43.
All right, okay. Senate Bill 43, Senator Dyson, you had an amendment that was passed out as U1. I'm going to go ahead and move that amendment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move amendment number one. It's 28 LS 0401/U, period one.
And I'll object to get the discussion out in the open. You have, Mr. Kopp going to speak to it?
Yeah, I will just say that our office listened to all the discussions here and the pushback from many people in the retail business about the limits between theft being a felony and a misdemeanor. And what our amendment here does from our office, it kind of cuts the baby in half. It goes between the existing limit and what you had produced and cuts it down to $1,000. I have a chart that we might distribute, but $1,000 puts it about exactly where most of the western states are. And if it isn't the average, it's very close to being the mean, and I think it's a reasonable compromise, and respectful of your opinion that it'd be higher. And Mr. Kopp will explain how the amendment, how it works in the bill. He's my chief of staff.
Representative Mr. Kopp, you want to go ahead and speak to it briefly?
Yes, Senator Coghill. Page 1, line 6, delete 1,500, insert 1,000. Page 1, line 14, delete 1,500, insert 1,000.
Read
those into the record?
Bill.
Yes, sir. Yeah, there is no other, Mr. Chairman, there's no other changes other than deleting the upper proposed limit in the CS of 1,500 and inserting the newly proposed upper threshold of 1,000.
Any discussion on this, Senator Wilkowski? Yeah, I've been convinced that it's probably the right way to go, so I will go ahead and remove my objection. We'll accept the amendment. You know, I wouldn't mind moving the bill forward, but if you want to sit on it for a day, that's fine. Is there any one-third of the voting body here who can that slow us down?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we move CS for Senate Bill 43 as amended with an attached fiscal note. I don't think there is one. And individual recommendations and on to the next committee of referral.
Any objection? Okay, then we'll move CS for Senate Bill 43 as amended with the individual recommendations. And so we'll do those recommendations at the end of the committee. Without objection, that bill moves. And it'll go on to, I think, the Finance Committee at this point. That brings us to Senate Bill 22. And we have a variety of amendments. Senate Bill 22 has been quite an interesting conversation in this committee. I think this is number 8th time we've had it before us, but I think it's been some good work, so I'm very grateful. Ms. Carbonetti, are you going to be the one speaking to for and against the amendments?
Mr. Sabani and I are going to share that.
Why don't you both come to the table? And I see the extra horsepower was brought to the committee. Okay. And I do have some folks online, just in case anybody on the committee wants to ask their opinion or get their expertise. We got Lieutenant Rodney Dial, the Alaska State Troopers, on for questions. We got Tom Stinson from the ACLU online for questions, and Quinlan Steiner online, public defender available for questions.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. I believe we have our amendment on volunteers before us, do we not?
Seemed to me like we did, yes.
And I have want to amend or substitute an updated amendment on the same subject.
I think the best thing to do, that was the U4 amendment that was before us.
Right.
And you have a different version that you do. Why don't we just withdraw that U4?
Okay.
And so why don't you make that motion or withdraw it, and I'll ask for any objections.
All right. Mr. Chairman, I move that we withdraw the amendment, the U4 amendment that was proffered in the last committee hearing.
And I can't remember for sure, but I think that was amendment number 2. Do you remember? 4. Oh,
four.
It actually followed the numbers, didn't it?
4, I think.
Okay. Thank you. That's something I didn't keep track of. Do you want to go ahead and visit that issue now, Senator?
What I'd like to do is, with that motion or amendment withdrawn, I'd like to offer a substitute.
And this will be a new amendment. This will be amendment number 5, right? Okay, and what? Which one is that one, Senator?
It's this one. It's the backslash U, period 1-6.
Okay, got it. We'll call this amendment number 5. And I'll object. This deals with volunteers. Would you please explain?
Yeah, I'd like to have my chief of staff explain it, if you may.
All right. Why don't you just go ahead and pull up a chair.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, just pull up another chair.
You got to get close enough to the...
Thank you.
Look at that. The way he moves the Department of Law, this is a phenomenal.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Chuck Kopp, staff to Senator Dyson. Amendment U.16, I think you just referred to it as Amendment 5.
Right.
This was a clarification. It stays with the original sponsor intent on the amendment, but in reviewing it with legal services, this is the draft that we really should have offered the first time. It deletes all of the language on lines 13 and 14 of page 19 that adds, or I should say it carves out the special exception for athletic coaches, saying that with respect to subsection 9, in performance of their occupational or volunteer duties. And the reason why that language was in the original bill is because all the other occupational mandatory reporters are just that. They're occupational. They're either paid or they're appointed, except for volunteer athletic coaches. So that language, when it says, or with respect to 9, which is athletic coaches of this subsection, they clarify that it's in performance of their occupational or volunteer duties, or we could say paid or unpaid duties. So by just removing the language or volunteer, it would be kind of double speak, because it mentions occupational duties on lines 11 and 12, and then it would be mentioning it again in line 14. So it clarifies the original intent of the bill sponsor with the amendment.
You said all those words. I could not follow everything, so I'm still catching up with you.
No problem. Mr. Chairman, just page 19 of the bill, of the CS.
Mm-hmm. 913.
Right. And if I'd refer you to line 10, where section 36 begin, that's all the mandated reporters.
Okay.
And then where you see there where it says on line 11, the following persons who, in the performance of their occupational duties... And then it lists all the mandated reporters, which are all occupational or paid employees, or in the respect of one board where there's appointees. The rest is occupational.
Okay. So
the language there, 13 and 14, we determined with legal services needs to come out if we are going to limit the criminal liability for fail to report to just paid athletic coaches, which the bill sponsors supports, that athletic coaches who are paid should be mandated reporters. But to limit that and protect volunteers, we needed to strike the underlying language there beginning on line 13.
All right. Okay, I understand now.
Okay.
So at this point, a volunteer would not be a mandated reporter, but a professional being paid would, under these descriptions, peace officer, practitioner, school teacher, paid employees, and coaches who are paid, true?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, that's correct.
Okay. And the volunteer question has been brought up. I understand you brought somebody to testify on this, and I have two online to testify on it. Am I understanding you correctly on that?
Yes, Senator Coghill is correct.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, why don't we go ahead and get the public testimony out of the way, and then we'll discuss this between us and the Department of Law.
Okay.
So why don't you go ahead and have your person come up and testify, and then I've got Diane Payne with the Director of Justice for Native Children online, and I've got Scooter Welch, Research Center for Parents and Children online. Both of them want to testify. So, all
right. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
May I introduce our speaker?
Yes, Senator Dyson, please. Right.
This is Lee Kettinger, who I've met 10 years ago or so and become a bit of a friend. But Lee was amongst the top-rated wrestlers in the country when he was in college, and was an All-American wrestler at 165 pounds. So I encourage people to argue with him to be thoughtful about it. But anyways, Lee has been a volunteer coaching wrestling here in the Juneau area for the last 11 years. And Lee has a lot of experience in the very area that we're talking about, and that's why I thought he'd be good to testify.
Okay. Lee, just go ahead and identify yourself and any affiliation.
Sure. My name is Lee Kettinger. I'm just representing myself today, I suppose, and probably many other volunteers and parents and aunts and uncles out there. But Mr. Chair and honorable members of the committee, thank you for your opportunity to testify on this important proposed legislation. I'll leave with you my written statement that I'll now try to summarize. My name is Lee Kettinger. I'm a father. I'm also a foster parent for 9 years, and I've coached wrestling extensively throughout Alaska for the last 11 years, as well as in Wisconsin, where I'm originally from. I'm here today to personally testify in support of Senate Bill 22, and I commend the governor for shining a light on what I view as a pervasive cancer in our society here in Alaska: child abuse, sexual assault, and sex trafficking. I support the intent of this legislation. However, I have a concern about some language and the ramifications of that change, on which I'll elaborate shortly. In my professional life as Chief Operating Officer for the Alaska Heritage Institute, I am acutely aware of the growing issue of sex trafficking, primarily of Alaska Native women from rural communities, who are being brought to Anchorage, separating from their support networks, and separated from their support networks. Strengthening state laws to mere federal laws, combined with education, will help in beginning to address this issue. Through my personal life as a foster parent, over the previous years, both my wife and I have seen the devastating effect that sexual and physical abuse has on children. I believe every single one of them that we've had has had either one or the other, or a combination of the both. Some of it's very visible: the malnourishment, neglect of proper medical care, and in some cases, visible physical abuse. However, some of the abuse is very hard to even notice or understand. I can provide countless examples of the obvious stuff, that any person with morals, ethics, and a basic sense of humanity would report immediately if they saw, regardless of your position or requirement to do so. On the other hand, there's a very different kind of abuse that is difficult to detect: the sexual abuse and the mental and emotional abuse. I've had some training over the years in youth protection through my volunteer service with Boy Scout and other organizations. But in my personal experience, it's extremely difficult to detect some types of abuse, especially if I'm only going to be spending an hour or so in a wrestling room every now and then. My wife seems to have an acute sense or gut feeling about these types of things, but I just don't seem to have that gut feeling. I mention this background as a coach and as a volunteer for hundreds of various youth over the years, because I have found some of these signs difficult to detect. The proposed changes in this bill that add athletic coaches, including paid or volunteer, who have reasonable cause to report the harm to the OCS office and failure to do so will hold them accountable are very concerning from a legal liability standpoint. These are moms and dads. These are aunts and uncles, brothers and sisters, who at many times volunteer at a moment's notice. They aren't formally trained. They don't have training what to look for. And under this proposed inclusion, they would be legally responsible or legally liable, both criminally and civilly, for reporting that. So would this mean that I, as a volunteer coach who comes in a few times a year, may be held liable for not reporting something for which I'm untrained to fully understand and which is difficult to detect? Should I, as a coach, report each circumstance as possible indicators just to ensure I won't face liability? I went online on the DHSS website and looked at possible indicators for child abuse. And some of them are children who are frequently late or absent, children who are hyperactive, destructive, and aggressive. If you've ever watched a wrestling practice, a lot of kids are aggressive. Children who are undernourished and go without breakfast. Children who are tired or withdrawn. Self-destructive behavior, including drugs or alcohol. In thinking about the wrestling team, I would think every single child may exhibit one of those factors, being tired, hungry, you name it, at some time or another. If I don't report those students that are late or absent or tired or hungry, am I going to have that civil or criminal liability should one of them have an issue? As a parent, I've had numerous times where my sons were trying to make weight for wrestling, were dieting, skip breakfast, which represents the possible indicators above. In sports, there are many days where a child's practicing in the morning and evening and may be tired, which is another possible indicator above. While these may be innocent enough, would not reporting them constitute a potential violation if the kid is being abused? This may sound absurd, but I have found that the argument of common sense isn't always a very defensible one. Accusations of abuse are a very serious matter. Any time that a parent applies for a job and is asked, "Have you ever been investigated for a criminal act for which you are not prosecuted?" Very common on job applications these days. If I reported that kid for being tired and hungry, and they went and talked to the parent, that parent would have to say on that job application that, yes, they were investigated. However, nothing may be materialized out of it. But as an employer, I would also take keen interest to people who say, yes, I was investigated for child abuse. I think that's a very difficult thing to place on somebody, and I have concern about that. It would be very difficult to explain. It could cost people their jobs, all because an inexperienced volunteer or an inexperienced coach reported something as suspicious, which OCS is mandated to investigate. It's hard enough to get good coaches and parental help in youth sports as it is. I believe that this provision would deter volunteers and potential coaches from serving. I can attest that coaching isn't done for the money. It's done for appreciation and giving back to the sports that we all enjoyed as kids. I would never, statistically speaking, it is very likely that I have coached children over the years who have had some sort of abuse that I didn't notice, or that I didn't realize, or that I didn't understand. I would never overlook this on purpose, and it is a great concern to me to know that under this provision, if I did overlook it, I may be held liable in the future, both civilly and criminally, for not reporting behavior that is listed as one of the indicators that I previously mentioned. On the other hand, if I report each and every potential indicator of abuse, I would have many unhappy parents. Should this provision regarding coaches and volunteers remain, I recommend that extensive trainings be provided as to what should be reported and that extreme caution is paid to some of the aforementioned concerns, for both the sake of the children, the parents, and the volunteers. As a foster parent, I see the impacts of this every day. As a volunteer coach, I have concerns about being liable for not noticing something. And as a resident, the state of Alaska. I appreciate your thoughtful consideration of the issues.
Thank you. I appreciate that. This has garnered a little more attention than I had expected, but I have another person who called in to testify. So I'm going to go to testimony and only ask, I'm not going to limit your time, but I'd ask you stay as concise as you can. Scooter Welch, you're on. Can you hear us?
Yes, sir. Thank you so much for the opportunity. And again, this is Scooter Welch. I'm the executive director of the Resource Center for Parents and Children here in Fairbanks, Alaska. And out of our center, we operate one of the child advocacy centers in Alaska called Stevie's Place. We do appreciate the discussion that's occurring on this bill and appreciate the governor and the legislators' efforts to look at this and try to protect our children. It is a responsibility on all of us as adults to do all that we can that is reasonable when we have suspicions of abuse, whether it be sexual, physical, or otherwise. And we strongly support the bill. I've been in the law enforcement and justice system since 1971. I continue to do that through my teaching at the University of Alaska. And I'm a retired chief of police here in Alaska. Sex offenders will find a place to abuse if we don't do everything that we can. Many organizations have now found out how critical it is to have too deep leadership and to report these incidents. I did not have the time to research what the requirements currently are for coaches and organized sports, volunteer or otherwise, but our organization requires everyone to have a background check, whether it be employee or volunteer, and we do all that we can to train them in the work that we do as a nonprofit. I've been involved in sports with not only myself but my children in coaching, and I recognize the concerns that we have and the difficulties for people who say I'm untrained, but if we're going to require people to be mandatory reporters, we need to ensure that in these organized activities, we provide the resources for them to understand that, and that can be done very simply. So I appreciate the opportunity to support the bill, and of course I'm available anytime for questions.
And first of all, thank you for coming in to testify on this, Mr. Welch, and also for all the work you do at FRA and have done in the Interior. My deepest appreciation. Any questions for Ms. Welch?
No, but thank him for his service.
Yeah, thank you for your service, Scooter. And
well, again, it's RCPC, just for clarification.
Oh, you're right. I'm sorry, Stevie's question.
That's okay, sir.
Yes, you're right.
Well, there are many great organizations in this Fairbanks community, as you know, sir. And yes, we're just one of those, and we want to continue the good work and protect our children every way possible.
And which you've gotten a lot of support from members on this committee on, so
yes.
Thank you. Sorry for
thank
that.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Diane Payne also is on. Diane, can you hear us?
Yes, I can. Thank you.
Go ahead and identify yourself and put yourself on record. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. My name is Diane Payne. I'm the director of the Justice for Native Children Project. My office is based in Eagle River. However, I work statewide and sometimes nationwide around the issues that relate to the safety of children and helping the system be more responsive to children who've been victimized. And I just have a few comments about this bill. I support the bill, and I support the language and any efforts that we can. As a state, I've been in the state of Alaska for over 30 years, raised my children here, and my grandchildren are growing up here as well. And I'm acutely aware of the high volume of children that are vulnerable in the state of Alaska to abuse. And what I want to point out to the committee is that as you deliberate this and the language and the verbiage and so forth, that keep in mind that children trust adults who have certain types of roles with them. And those are the people that children are more likely to tell or imply or hint if there is abuse occurring. And they're more likely to tell and trust adults that they see often and that they see in circumstances where they are enjoying life. They're allowed to be children. They're allowed to be free and to express themselves. And so I appreciate the comments that were made by the gentleman who's been a foster parent and a coach, and knowing that There's a lot of anxiety around whether or not we see all those signs. I spend a lot of my time training mandatory reporters right now in the state of Alaska, and there's a lot of concern, and there's a lot of a mystery sometimes around how children demonstrate that they've been abused or they're being abused. But I just want to keep us focused on the fact that adults who are working with children should feel free, should be comfortable, and should be required whenever possible to report suspicions that are reasonable, especially if they have observing children interact with other adults. And I just think that coaches and the people who are engaged with our children in play and adventurous activities, camps and things like that, are people who children trust, and children trust them to do something if something's wrong. So these are role models that we're talking about. We're talking about not talking about people knowing the detailed signs and behaviors, because even the most skilled of us who've been doing this for many years can't always tell. But that we have some reasonable requirements that say reporting is necessary to prevent things from becoming worse, to prevent things from escalating, and that anyone who is being investigated, who is being contacted because there may have been a suspicion of a concern, a parent or a guardian who has a child who is misbehaving or acting out or acting in a way that's not appropriate, usually wants to do something about that. And the response of a person being investigated says a lot about what that child's environment is. So I would just encourage the committee, as you think about this, to think about who children trust, who children have a right to trust, and also what environments people, where they find vulnerable children. Thank you so much for this opportunity.
Diane, I have a question for you. First of all, thank you for coming to testify. In doing the training, what is a reasonable time for training? Let's just say if it was volunteers, and this actually goes to mandate volunteers, what would be a reasonable training time so that they would have that kind of reasonable expectation that they could identify fairly well those signs for reporting purposes?
I think for a layperson, you know, someone who's outside of that, you know, day-to-day contact with children, such as teachers and people like that, the mandatory reporter CD that was produced by the state of Alaska that's online, available online at the OCS website, has a lot of information, and it has some supplemental handouts that I've done that training for, like, church groups or Lions clubs in, you know, an hour and a half. So I think for the layperson to have, here's some things that you should be concerned about. Here are the five things to say to a child. If you see the child acting out, shutting down, withdrawing, acting differently than they used to, you can say, I'm concerned about you. Is there anything I should know? So, I mean, those things are in that CD, and they're in the handouts that go with that CD. And I quite frankly think that's a minimum that any of us who have children or who are having kids spend the night at our houses ought to know those things.
Sure. One other question. You know, one of the problems that was brought up is what if somebody gets it wrong? They either miss it and they become somewhat liable. Certainly that must be a discussion you have among mandatory reporters now, is when do you actually make a report? What is the decision point? And that's probably pretty subjective, but once you do that, you become part of a legal proceeding. You know,
it is, and the current law says that if you fail to report and a child is then harmed and you had information that you didn't report, then there's a consequence. Mm-hmm. What I say to mandatory reporters who are current mandatory reporters under the law is that it's the job of the investigators to figure out whether or not something rises to the level of even needing to be investigated. And so I would like to believe, and I spend a lot of time interacting with OCS and with law enforcement throughout the state, that our investigators have the skills to screen the kinds of reports that they're getting, to know which ones of those actually require going and talking to the parent or going and seeing the child. There's a threshold based on the type of information that's being reported. So I guess I would allay the fears a little bit around just this huge volume of people being interrogated, because I don't think that really happens in reality. I think our screeners and our intake workers, if someone reports that a child is acting out violently towards an animal, that's usually a pretty big red flag about, a level of abuse that's occurring. But if someone says, yeah, these kids got in a fight on the playground and one kid got hurt and the other kid, well, it depends on the circumstances and it depends on what else is known about that family, whether or not that would even have been investigated.
Thank you. Any other questions? Diane, I sure appreciate you chiming in on the discussion. It's very helpful to me.
Thank you, and I would make myself available. I've left my number with the staff if there's anything else I can do to be helpful.
Very grateful for that.
Thank you.
Also, we have Jessica Lawmaster with the Alaska Children Alliance. Jessica, can you hear us?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. Please identify yourself and give us your testimony.
Hi, my name is Jessica Lawmaster. I'm the executive director of a domestic violence sexual assault advocacy organization in Homer, Haven House. And through Haven House, we also administer 3 child advocacy centers across the Kenai Peninsula. And I also am the chair of the Alaska Children's Alliance, which is the statewide organization of child advocacy centers. Diane covered a big chunk of what I wanted to talk about, but I just also wanted to highlight the important nature of the relationship between the coach and the athlete. And we know in the field of child abuse that over 90% of the time in child sexual abuse cases, the abuse happens between with the child, with the perpetrator being somebody that they know and trust, and oftentimes that's somebody in their very own home or their family. I'm a child forensic interviewer, so I'm often the first or second person that receives a child's disclosure about various types of severe abuse, and I know that it is not uncommon for children to seek out other safe adults that they identify as a trusting and safe relationship, and it's not uncommon for us to see this happen with coaches. So there has been a gap we've identified through the child advocacy centers on a statewide level. We've acknowledged this gap in the past, long before the Penn State incidents ever occurred, the gap that coaches are not mandated reporters. And I would just like to echo a little bit about what Diane said. This bill asks coaches to report if they have personally a reasonable suspicion that abuse or neglect has occurred. It doesn't expect them to notify and report if a child exhibits a behavior that somebody out there might perceive for various reasons. It's if they personally have a concern, a reasonable suspicion that a child has been abused. And I would also like to say that I can't speak on behalf of OCS, but I work with OCS a lot, and in my experience, just because a report is made, that doesn't necessarily mean that person is going to be investigated. They have screening procedures. There's no harm in making a report that doesn't meet their threshold. They would simply screen it out and move on. Better safe than sorry, and we just strongly advocate that you consider making coaches mandated reporters, and I'm available for questions if you have any. Thank you.
For me, Jessica, first of all, thank you. In getting some of the reports that you may be aware of, I suppose one of the things that I struggle with is, just that enough knowledge to make a reasonable assessment. And, I guess one of the fears we have if we make them mandatory reporters is, would they be, less willing to serve or too willing to make reports because they're fearful that if they don't, there's an accountability problem? So under mandatory reporters already, is there that tension already, and how is that handled?
I honestly haven't had that experience with volunteers, and of course, in my experience working with volunteers, it's in a different context than coaches, but we actually have a policy through our organization that even though our volunteers aren't required by law to report child abuse, we require that on our own of our volunteers. We ask that, and as with our volunteers, I believe that hopefully most people who are volunteering their time to work closely with children have a genuine care and concern for their well-being and their safety, and I just have a lot of trust in people who would be giving their time to something like this, that that this would not deter them. I also have trust that that just as they would call 911 if they had an immediate concern for their safety, that they would call if they had, you know, a concern that might not be so urgent and right in front of them. I really don't believe I have been in a meeting with various representatives of law enforcement and other child advocacy centers and OCS, and we had this conversation together, and those of us who are already requiring volunteers to report it, we haven't experienced that anyone has been deterred, and quite frankly, if they were deterred, I would have concerns.
Yeah. All right, thank you very much. Any other questions? All right. Well, Senator Dyson, I will say this, you know how to get some attention. Anything from the Department of Law on this particular issue?
Just briefly, yes. Mr. Chairman, I understand both sides of this question, but I did want to be want to make it clear that a person does not have to report unless there's reasonable cause to suspect that the child has suffered harm. So it's not just because you see a bruise on a child's leg and you're in a soccer practice. The law doesn't hold people to that tough a standard. And then for criminal liability, the law provides that if you fail to report knowing or you should have known that a child was harmed or the circumstances gave rise for a need of report, so it's a knowing standard or should have known, and maybe you might want to think about whether volunteer coaches should just have to abide by the knowing standard. So there are provisions there, and there's also an immunity clause, a section that provides that 4717050 provides immunity for a person who makes a report in good faith but is mistaken. So there are protections in the law that would, you know, protect somebody from a claim that they may have been overzealous. And I would just like to give a little background as to why we included volunteer coaches and that's part of the governor's effort to reduce child abuse and neglect and sexual abuse and sexual assault. And that is the Coaching Boys Into Men program. They have learned in developing that program that there are a lot of coaches of kids, and I know this personally from when our children were playing sports. There are a lot of volunteer coaches. They do great work, and they do it because they love it, and they spend a lot of time with children, supervising them and working with them. And that's the reason why we think that the people who spend this much time with kids should be mandatory reporters, because they do spend a lot of time. They develop special relationships with kids, and there are a lot of them who spend a lot of time who are volunteers. Mm-hmm. And as I said before, there are protections in terms of when you have to report and the culpable mental state for crime. I will note we did a computer search of cases for, and it's 47. I think the criminal statute is for prosecutions under 47. 17-0068, which is the criminal provision, there's been one case referred to us in our history, and we declined that. We declined prosecution based on just the exercise of our prosecutorial discretion.
So probably what would more likely be the result of this is that training for volunteers would probably become mandatory.
Well, you know, I think what one of the testifiers said, there is training available, and I remember when I was helping out on little peewee basketball teams. I think that even Parks and Rec and Juno had a little session that they required parents who were coaching or whatever for these little teams. They had a session, and I don't remember whether we were specifically informed about child abuse and neglect or not, but I do know there was a forum there that it certainly could have been added, or people could have been directed to a website to just inform themselves. And so that's the reason why we think it's important that there are a lot of volunteer coaches who do spend a lot of time with children, and hopefully they would report anyway, but we thought it was reasonable to require them to report. Thanks.
Senator Dyson? Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Annie, looking at 4717022, it says a person employed by the state or by a school district who is required under this chapter to report abuse or neglect of a child shall receive training on the recognition and reporting of child abuse and neglect. Would the people who are volunteers for a school district have to be trained under this provision and reported under this provision?
My understanding is not very good, but I did have a conversation today with a person who works for the Alaska School Athletic Association, I think it is, and they informed me that coaches with direct supervisory authority over kids, even if they're volunteers, get training. I think that's right. That's correct.
Senator Dyson?
Yeah, thanks. We did a little research in our office about the history of these volunteer reporting things. Mm-hmm. See if it squares with your understanding.
Okay.
But I think that most of this came up in 1985 under Sheffield's administration, and it broadened the mandatory reporter categories. And one that came up was school professionals. And the governor's bill sought to broaden this category from teachers and administrators to, quote, employees and volunteers of private and public schools. If the bill were considered, the legislature struck down the concept of employees and volunteers and stuck with what it is today, the teachers and administrators, in essence, the professionals in the area. And then when child care providers came up, the governor sought to broaden the category from licensed daycare to all care providers. This bill's also included a new definition of child care providers. This change succeeded, was act in the law, and is what in the law today. But the definition of child care providers clarifies the term means an adult employee of an organization who provides care and supervision for compensation. So when they went through this before, they stuck to those who were paid, and almost everyone on the list, except without the child care providers, I believe is either certified or licensed and so on. So, you know, there was some thought went into all that. Other states, we found three states, there are only three that specifically require coaches or organized volunteers report. That's Louisiana, Virginia, and Washington. and that report was from the Mandatory Reporters of Child Abuse and Neglect by the Child Welfare Information Gateway. Anyways, and I can give you that. So we're not plowing new ground, but there's only three that are doing this with volunteers in athletic activities. So it's not like we're way behind. And I hope everybody that's considering this realizes that everyone can report. And being a mandatory reporter doesn't give your report any more weight than anyone else's. And in our statute, 1156-765A, you'll remember this one, Annie. You helped me on it. But it says that a person, any of you sitting in this room, who witnesses when a person or that what a person knows or reasonably should have known is required to report. And it runs through a list of things: murder, kidnapping, sexual penetration of a child, and all those things. So in that sense, everyone in Alaska is a mandatory reporter. If you know or reasonably should have known, you're required to go to the aid of that child or report it. And so that's already in the existing law. Any coach, any volunteer, any citizen who knows or reasonably should have known that a child is being harmed in these ways is required to report, and is the same penalty, Class A misdemeanor. So, you know, we're not extending the mandatory reporters here, in my view, in any significant way. And the mandatory reporters aren't to give the reporter some special status. It is, in fact, us using the hand of law to force people to be reporters and to do what all of us would think of as a reasonable duty anyways. So, anyways, any comments on that, Annie?
Well, no, I remember working on this, and it is kind of ironic that this is in the criminal law that you and I worked on over the years. But I agree, everybody should, but I think if you have a mandatory duty to do so, you might look a little bit more carefully, and that's...
But this one says you have a mandatory duty.
Well, it says if you know or should have known.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep.
And that's the same culpable mental state for Title 47, too.
Yep. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Probably the thing that I see that this will do is it will have anybody who is a paid coach then pretty much require that any volunteers working with them get the mandatory training. I would expect that include any paid or volunteer leader of an assistant sports team in a public private school, private post-secondary education, municipality-sponsored team, or any organization that gets public funding. So I think with that, funding would probably pretty much come the requirement that you have some training for mandatory reporting. Uh-huh. I just wonder what the value, how hard that, but according to the testimony of, I think it was Diane Payne, no, maybe it was, I think it was Diane Payne, that could be done in an hour, hour and a half. Uh-huh. My guess is you'd want to do that every year, though, just to remind yourself if you're a volunteer. Mm-hmm. My. All right. Any further discussion on this one? We have been now 40 minutes on that one. Let's vote on it.
All right. Done.
All right.
I'll just make a statement real
quick.
Sure. When I graduated law school 20 years ago, it was pretty much standard that the philosophy was typically the law was you wouldn't force people to take an action, and here that's what we're doing. And I'm always extremely reluctant to do that, and especially give prosecutors discretion to prosecute or not prosecute. But times change, and I did the same research that Senator Dyson did, and I see what you saw, I think it's the same website as childwelfare.gov. And what I'm seeing here is, it says four states now have designated as mandatory reporters, faculty, administrators, volunteers, et cetera, et cetera. But then I was surprised by the next paragraph, which says there are actually 18 states and Puerto Rico which require any person who suspects child abuse or neglect to report. So this seems to be a trend in the country. I don't know if it's growing or decreasing, but I think it's certainly increased in the last 20 years, and there are many states in the country that report anyone at all to report child abuse. So I guess I don't see this as being that onerous, but I certainly share the Senator Dyson's concerns, and this is a tough one, but I'm going to vote no on the amendment because of that.
And I just... might remind you of the citation I just quoted. We are one of those 18 states. It makes everybody, who knows.
Well, except maybe I can turn to Annie on that. I mean, I don't read the law that way. I see we're one that requires the list within 020, which is...
It's mandatory reporters.
People's mandatory reporters, but then anyone else may report, but... the way I'm reading this section is there are 18 states and Puerto Rico, any person who suspects child abuse or neglect is required to report. And I don't think Alaska is one of those states.
And if I'm Mr. Kopp, what ours says,
what's the citation on that?
1156
765.
765.
Thank you.
Witness, if you see it or reasonably should know, you're bound.
I would say that it is limited to if you knew or reasonably should know that the child was murdered, was subject to sexual penetration or attempted sexual penetration, or kidnapped. So it's limited to the most serious of crimes. It does not, or the assault of the child by another causing serious physical injury, and the child is under 16. So that. The crime in 1156-765 only applies to the most serious crimes, and the reporting would be broader in the sense that you would be required to report neglect and various other things too, if you reasonably believe that it was happening. I think we shouldn't worry too much about a concern about civil liability, because there's an immunity section in 47-17 that protects people from that. Some people are worried about civil liability despite those, but I think the legislature has done what it can to protect people who might be mistaken but report out of an excess of caution.
This is a tough one for me, too, because, when people are paid to coach, you would expect a higher degree of responsibility. When you have volunteers, because they're quite often coming in either as a helper or they're just not there as much as the coach would be. The coach probably would be the more likely to be aware of the youngsters. But in this particular case, I get conflicted because many of these volunteers are the full-time coach. Mm-hmm. And so that becomes one of the bigger issues. Having talked about the civil liability a little further than I had thought through, it even gets me more conflicted, because I was prepared to stay with just those who get paid to do this. And as Senator Dyson said so many times, I agree with my friends. And so my friend over here says volunteers should be reporters, and my friend over here says it should be more to the paid. Really puts me in a tough spot, but at this particular point, I'm going to agree with the governor and not accept this amendment. I just think that in weighing everything that I've heard, I'm going to have to end up in that direction and be one of the enemies to my buddy to the left here. So, Senator Dyson, I'm going to have to not be able to vote with your amendment. My apologies to you, because I led him to believe that I was going to vote with it, because I thought the civil liability was much higher, and having heard this today, that there would be some immunity and that the training is closer to just an hour and a half, I think that's reasonable.
I want to make it clear that you understand that it's immunity for making a report.
Right.
It's not immunity. It doesn't. Well, anyway, we can talk about that later. But
well, and that was one of my questions I had, though, is the fear of making the report and actually having the civil liability for being reluctant to make a report when you just didn't know, and
mm-hmm.
Fearfulness of the circumstances. To me, that was creating such a high bar for volunteers that if they didn't know what they were getting into, it could be awkward for them. Mm-hmm. So,
it's a tough decision.
Yeah. But at this point, Senator Wilkoski.
I really appreciate the discussion. It's certainly brought to light a whole new area that I haven't looked into in many, many years. But I know the bill has another referral, I believe, mm-hmm. to finance. I mean, maybe in that time, if there are 18 other states that have this reporting requirement for everyone, I mean, maybe we can do a little research and see how it's working in those states, if it's caused problems or not. Because the last thing I think any of us want to do is discourage volunteers from coming out and potentially exposing them to liability. So, I guess I'd be open to change in the future if there were some definitive evidence that it wasn't working out in many other states. But at this point, I'm gonna vote no.
Would you be willing to follow some of the research on that, Senator Dyson?
Probably. I'll just say one more thing. Those of you that think volunteers ought to be mandatory reporters, I'd encourage you to go all the way through the list. And all the other volunteers who are around children, you know, and be consistent. But that's all I want to say.
You know, that's a good point, too, isn't it? You know, how many volunteers would you see that would work with a group of children outside of coaching?
How about Sunday school teachers?
Yeah. And, you know, in the work that I'd done previously, I did do background checks on Sunday school teachers. But they are not mandatory reporters, the way I understand it.
And scouts and Boys and Girls Club, Campfire Girls, Boys and Girls Club in my city run a lot of athletic programs.
Would the governor be willing to investigate making all volunteers reporters and that work with groups of children?
I'd like to think about that. I would certainly bring it to the attention of the governor's office and talk about it.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly would be willing to have a conversation about it.
So at this point, then, I will vote with my friend, Senator Dyson. I think that's he brings up such a good point that I need to, it causes me some pause to go down that road. So I will agree with him on that. But knowing that my propensity is to head in that direction, I think that's a bigger question, though. So, all right. We better call the roll on this one before I change my mind again. As you can see, it's that close of a call.
Oops.
Dyson.
Yes.
Senator Willikowski.
No.
Senator Coghill.
Yes.
2 days, 1 day.
Does that pass or fail, Mr. Chair?
The amendment passes, but I do feel that this will probably be open for discussion along the way. And I think the argument, the last argument the Senator made, on making all volunteers of all groups mandatory reporters, I think is probably the next question we have to answer. So,
and just as a, I guess, a procedural issue, it's been my impression that in order for an amendment to pass, you need a majority of the total quorum. Is that an incorrect?
The majority of those present can pass an amendment, but I think that you make a good point, and that's something I was really reluctant to do. And but we passed out a bill, of course, where that was unanimous consent. But I think a majority of those present can do amendments.
So. Ready to bill? Move the bills?
Well, we have several amendments. That was probably one of the more intense ones, no doubt about it. We have another half an hour, and we have several amendments in front of us. Let me take a brief of these while we get them all in front of you. I've got all these on the record. Thank you. Sorry for the delay. We just wanted to double check to make sure that we're on track. We checked with Mr. Gardner, who's our alleged legal guy, to make sure that the majority of those present could actually pass an amendment, and that is true. So we'll continue on with the amendments. Otherwise, I was going to have to call the committee to an end. That brings us to amendment number 5-6, which would be U.6, which is on page 7, line 31. And this takes the monitoring program and amends it to say active. So I will move amendment number 6, which is U.6. You want to object so that we can talk about it?
Sure.
So the objection has been noted by Senator Dyson. This was brought up as we were talking about monitoring program under global positioning systems, both on page 7, line 31, and page 8, line 16. This would require active, and my thinking was if it's really a safety issue, it probably should be that. How it's paid for is discretionary, just like the application of this is discretionary.
Mm-hmm.
Any comment on that, Annie?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I remember the conversation that we had. And I just want to clarify that the procedures for this GPS monitoring system have not been developed by the Department of Corrections yet. They have some experience doing it, and they'll be working with the Department of Public Safety. My concern is that if you add an active in both of those places, you're really limiting them in terms of what choices they can make. And although I assume it would be active. I've just been informed by Department of Corrections. There is one type of monitoring system called the Econ 1 that is passive until the defendant enters into an exclusionary zone, at which point it becomes active.
Cool.
So that's a good example of why maybe, I mean, there's also the other possibility of a similar technological means, but if you put an active global positioning system, you might be boxing in their choices. And I don't know, that's the only example of a choice that might be a less expensive one, might be a better one, that you might be excluding by adding that amendment.
Any discussion on it? Senator Bilkoski.
Well, I support the amendment. I think it sends a message that I think passive global monitoring in a situation like this is a waste. And my understanding is we've got passive systems. You know, if you're trying to protect someone from stalking, it doesn't help anybody to have them plug their monitor in the next day into a modem and report it. The damage has already been done. And I think in the situation where where you're talking about, I mean, we can establish legislative history right now. I mean, my intent is active at the time the person engages and violates his conditions of parole or probation. I support the amendment, Mr. Chair. You decide to not withdraw it.
I understand that flexibility is given the court here, but Senator Dyson, any comment?
Well, these particular circumstances, it would almost inconceivable to me that it wouldn't be a system that would participate or protect the potential victim in real time. But I appreciate Annie's position that she doesn't want, I think, and I don't want, is us to use a term here that would limit other technologies in the future.
So this could, the way I understand it, Senator Dyson, is this. The way the language is without this amendment, they could use either or other technology that was GPS related that we may not know about. If we say active, it narrows it.
I don't. What we want them to do is use the best technology or techniques that are available at the time. And all of us know there are going to be some economic limits on that.
Right.
You know, if the very best one costs $10,000. The next level down is $150. You know, there's some judgment there.
Well,
I don't know how to solve that dilemma. I want the victim to be protected with the best that's available and in real time.
Okay, I'm going to withdraw the amendment, and I'll tell you why. We are directing them to keep the safety of the victim in mind, and it is in consultation with the Department of Corrections. My guess is if there was a safety issue act, it would be more likely than not.
I'm assuming that it would be active anyway. We had a conversation earlier, Senator Wilikowski and I had the conversation. I think it would be, but I am no expert on this. And so.
Well, the two issues, if anybody ever listens to our committee meeting, it was the idea that they would head towards the most active they can get. Mm-hmm. But if it wasn't necessary, that the Department of Corrections actually had that discretion. Mm-hmm. This court certainly has that discretion.
Yes.
And if we take that discretion away by mandating only one type, it may be incorrect. So I withdraw the amendment.
Yeah. And, Mr. Chairman, I think you're wise, but I would encourage all of us to not use words like active that might become a term of art. What we want is the most effective, you know, in real time. Just like global positioning system, GPS, that's new in all of our vocabulary in the last 10 years, and who knows what it'll be the time your grandchildren are sitting where you are.
Point well taken. So amendment number 6 is withdrawn. I will move amendment number 7, which is dot 7, if you'll object so that I can explain it. Senator Dyson?
Object.
So amendment number 7 is on page 9, line 19, adds the word after trial on line 19, and it adds the words, or at a later time, as a court may, for good cause, permit. And then following may on line 20, insert for good cause shown. This has to deal with let me make sure my note's correct here. This is evidence being admitted, true?
Yes, this is the rape shield law.
And so we had talked about this previously. Annie, any comment on this one?
Mr. Chairman, I think this has already been decided. Mm-hmm. You know, our concern always is what is good cause, but we can leave that up to the discretion of the judge.
Okay. Any objection to Amendment Number 7? Okay, we'll call Amendment Number 7 passed. And then we'll go to Amendment Number 8, which I have done here as dot 8. I'll move Amendment Number 8.
I'll object. Report pursuit of discussion.
This goes to relating to granting immunity. This is one that I struggled with. This is the whole idea of mandating the witness to come before the judge. So this takes that whole section out, Annie. And so I told you I was going to propose this. And as you can see, I can be changed. My mind can be changed right here in committee, which is not a wise thing for me. But I'm open to discussion on this particular issue.
Well, unfortunately, Rick Savani was going to speak on this amendment because he has more experience in granting immunity. But I'll take a stab at it. The problem is when the problem arises in cases where the judge orders, and they're usually really serious cases, where the judge finds a privilege for the witness and requires us to immunize the witness in order to require them to testify. And that's by itself is not necessarily a problem, but the problem arises is in the situation where if our attorney decides that we will not grant immunity to that witness, what happens then? The real serious concerns come when the trial judge tells us, if you are not willing to grant immunity to this witness, I'm going to dismiss the murder case against the defendant. And that's our real concern, because then we are having to decide immunity in a really serious case without the knowledge of what the witness has said. And I don't say that we should get that knowledge, but it's a tough position to be in. So we want that decision to be the best decision possible, which is why we think that the judge should listen to the witness, him or herself, and then make findings so that it can be reviewed by an appellate court. And that's what Section 17 is. And Rick told me that he was going to say that he understands your concerns that have been raised, but he would hope that even if you decided not to change, adopt the changes in Section 16, you would consider leaving 17 in so that the judge, when he or she decides that the person has a Fifth Amendment privilege and make written findings so that it can be reviewed by a higher court.
So the question I had, and I think I thought of it before ACLU did, so was how do you make an appeal in the middle of a case that is timely enough to make this work? I think that was one of the concerns. I didn't state it quite like that, but that's how ACLU stated it.
But, you know, they've got a good concern. The problem is the cases that we are concerned about are the ones where the judge says, if you don't grant immunity, we're going to dismiss the murder charge. So our courts have many cases where they are required to do an expedited appeal. This should and we do this all the time now. We petition. We don't have right of appeal, but we take petitions, in which is asking the court to please, if they would, in their discretion, review this decision. And it has been done before. It's done on an expedited basis, and it could be done here. It's, you know, as you said before, how do you make an appeal? Well, you do it very gingerly because you don't know what exactly they're saying. But you can say, the judge said, we have to, if we don't grant immunity in this case, he or she is going to dismiss the underlying charge. And, you know, we don't, these are, you know, the latest case was a murder charge out of Palmer, I think. So it just, it's a delay. The courts handle it on an expedited basis, and that you get your decision and you move on. So we do it now with petitions. We could do it with the same. I mean, it's we don't know what the witness said, but we can argue the
what about my
circumstances that we know.
What about my concern about you got to get a proffer for the witness, there's, you know, in my view, there use for significant intimidation at this point.
A proffer?
No. If the witness now has to come before the judge, and the proffer is already spoken on behalf of the witness, is the way I understand it.
Mm-hmm.
And now you have the judge will take the witness in. It just seems to me like there's huge opportunity for intimidation of a witness at that point.
Mr. Chairman, I suppose any judge could intimidate somebody if they wanted to.
You intimidate.
But I don't know why this would be more intimidating. I mean, the person would have their lawyer right there to represent him or her. It would be less. Those are the three people in the in-camera proceeding: the judge, the lawyer, the witness, and the witness's lawyer. So the witness's lawyer would be there to defend the witness, you know, the more information the judge has in making this decision, and the credibility of the witness is critical to that decision. And you don't get a feeling. And, you know, sometimes the witness doesn't even go to these hearings. And that's taking away a part of fact-finding that should be required for a court to make a decision that's the best that he or she can make.
Any questions? I'm a layman, I understand that, but I just struggle with this provision. So I'm going to maintain the amendment, I just struggle with both provisions, and I don't understand Section 17 enough really to make that, because I know you have the ability to appeal what they call an interlocutory.
Yes.
And that means you kind of stop a case to go find out if this witness credibility can get either the immunity or if they're going to be forced to testify, if I understand correctly.
Well, what they review is that the judge would be required to explain in writing the real or substantial danger that the proffer or testimony would support a conviction. And that's the concern that the witness has, that he or she is giving information that would support a conviction for a crime. And that's what the review would be. And without it, there's no review of this decision. If the defendant is convicted, the defense attorney can review it. We never, if the defendant is not, or whatever happens, the state never gets a chance to get this reviewed by a court of appeals. So it's one person making a decision that you know, most Superior Court judges' decisions are subject to review, but this one, there is not another way to get a review.
Let me explain to you how I see it as kind of a layman in this area of the world.
Uh-huh.
I always think that an individual citizen is free until the state can show there's some reason they shouldn't be free.
Uh-huh.
I think this gives the state a little more horsepower over that individual. And even if they're wrong, I understand the point that you make. So that's kind of one side of the issue. The other side is a kind of a free citizen being kind of pushed by the state in areas where they shouldn't be pushed. And so I think I'm trying to weigh that in my mind, how this really works. And it's tied up in procedure that I still struggle with. You know, I'm open to suggestion from anybody on the committee. If you think we ought to look at this further, I'm game. Senator Wilkowski?
I support you, Mr. Chair. I support your amendment 100%. And two reasons. Number one, this is bedrock constitutional law. You are changing the law to require people to testify against themselves. That's just fundamental constitutional law. Number two, the interlocutory appeal section, it's in a sealed written envelope, except when the appellate division makes their findings, they're going to have to base their findings. And I don't see how they get around not disclosing what's in the sealed confidential envelope. So I understand your dilemma, but your dilemma is a dilemma that's imposed upon you by the Constitution of the State of Alaska and of the United States.
So is there any objection to the amendment number 8? All right, amendment number 8 passes. We have 5 more minutes, so... I have let's see here. I don't have it here with me. All right. Okay. Well, here's my dilemma. I'm going to skip over to one. Annie, I want to give you one that you brought to me. This is AM1 Carpinetti, dated 2/19/2013. And this deals with Section 8. Do you have that in front of you guys? I think it's the last amendment in your packet.
What's the number? U dot.
It's AM1, and that'll be amendment number 9. You have that in front of you, Annie?
I have it somewhere.
Let's just take a piece for a second. Get back online. The members of the committee graciously agreed to stay here an extra 10 minutes so we can just kind of plow through these. I'm going to move this one called AM/1, which is amendment number 9. Senator Dyson, would you?
I'm sorry, AM1 or AM2?
AM1.
I'm sorry. Can I move amendment AM1?
Well, I already moved it. You just need to object.
I object.
So that we can talk about this. This is an amendment brought to us. Annie, would you go through this one real quick?
Yes, I will. It was, you know, this was as a result of some of the discussions we had about the addition of sexual assault by a probation or parole officer. And it would create an affirmative defense for a probation or parole officer to have sexual relationships with a person on probation or parole if they had a pre-existing dating or sexual relationship and the relationship continued until the date of the alleged offense.
Do you have a copy of that in front of you, Senator Wilkowski?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Is there any objection to this amendment? Hearing none, we'll take amendment number 9.
So, yeah, oh. That's fine. I don't want to reduce that. Just Annie?
Yes?
Explain to me what this first three things here about delete section 22, 23, insert, delete 22, and what does that all do?
Those confused me, too, when I first looked at them, and it just changes the numbers
It's conforming.
They conform the numbers so that what was 22 is now 23, and what was 23 is now 24. I don't think they have any substantive effect.
Okay, thank you.
On the bill. Sorry, it is confusing when they're in this form.
And that's one of the reasons why we'll bring this back as a CS. We'll kind of take a look at it. You'll get a chance to kind of examine it before we pass it out, I think. I have one here that is called U.9. And I will move amendment number 10, which is the U.9.
Object for purpose of discussion.
And on the back of this amendment, I have language written that will show the language written in the positive. This goes to the Collins case and trying to find language that states what the court, when they can refer to a three-judge panel in a more positive language. And if you look on the back, it shows the actual language that the amendment actually puts together. It's just that I had to do it in the different lines on page 12, line 13, 14, 15, 21, 22, 23, and 24. But if you look on the back, it actually writes it out in its final verbiage. And the AS 1255-165 on page 12, it would read as such: a court may not refer a case to a three-judge panel under A of this section if the defendant is being sentenced for a sexual felony under AS 1255-125-I. And the request for the referral is based on the claim that the defendant either singly or in combination has, one, prospects for rehabilitation that are less than extraordinary, or two, a history free of unprosecuted, undocumented, or undetected sexual offenses. And it follows a similar language in 1255-75, which is section 23 under parens F. A defendant being sentenced for sexual felony under 1255-125-I may not establish, nor may the three-judge panel find under B of the section or any other provision of law, that manifest injustice would result from the imposition of a sentence from the presumptive range if the defendant either singly or in combination has, one, prospects for rehabilitation that are less than extraordinary, or two, a history free of unprosecuted, undocumented, or undetected sexual offenses. And the testimony I got on this amendment is, if we were to add solely on the parent C or 165 after based on, or in the middle of based on, based solely on the claim, is what I understand.
Yes, that we have two suggestions, and that's a result of Mr. Quinlan Steiner and I working on this to allay his concerns, and that would be on the third line of section 22 would be for the referral is based solely on the claim that the defendant either singly or in combination has.
I'd like to make that as an amendment to the amendment. Is there objection to that? All right. So the word solely is inserted between based on, and then you also add one under 1255-175, section 23.
Yes, the fourth line down, it would read, well, let me just, I'll start at the third line, that manifest injustice would result from imposition of a sentence within the presumptive range based solely on the claim that the defendant. So you take out the word if and add the words based solely on the claim that the.
So I will move that we take out between range and the on the fourth line, conceptual amendment, basically, because that's where we're at, and insert, so we delete if and insert based solely on the claim that.
Yes.
Objection to that?
I like it.
So just, right. Quinlan Steiner, this is something you worked out with him?
Yes.
Okay.
All right, so that brings the amended amendment before us, which is amendment number 10. Is there any objection to amendment number 10? Seeing none, amendment number 10 then gets adopted. That brings us to U.11, which is to be amendment number 11. I will move amendment number 11, which is U.11. Anyone object so we can talk about this?
Correct.
So it goes to page 21, line 6. And it would delete the word the on page line 6 and add the word if the crime involved a crime, comma, the court may not. And this, Annie, could you explain deals with a court rule amendment?
Yeah, the court rule amendment just requires the court to not accept a pre-sentence report if it doesn't address the victim's the harm to the victim and the victim's impact statement, basically. This just says it's the inserted language that I have that I think is if the crime involved a victim.
Right.
So that the court, you know, it wouldn't apply to a crime that doesn't have a victim or, you know, what is considered a victimless crime.
So it's more emphatic on it just has to have a report that involves the victim.
Yeah, you wouldn't want to require a victim impact statement on a...
Let's just clarify the language. Any objection?
My objection.
All right. Amendment number 11 passes. That brings us to U.12, which I'll call amendment number 12. I will move U.12, 11, amendment number 12.
Check.
This is on page 14. It's under section 26, and it is a mistake, I think, that we had, which deals, it adds the word $10,000 in there where $5,000 is, and I think it was meant to be $10,000, if I'm correct. Let me just make sure I get there. I'm sorry. I'm sorry. So, let me take a brief of these for a second. I don't know what I'm talking about here then, because it doesn't take much to confuse me. I slipped on you on that one. This actually deals with 1865-865, which is different than the present 26. So would you explain this to us, Annie?
Yes. Perhaps it would be best just to compare it to Section 26 on page 14, starting on line 5. That's a conforming amendment.
Okay.
And on certain domestic violence protective orders or for violation of certain provisions, it can be a misdemeanor on just seven of the various possible conditions that may be placed on a domestic violence protective order. Violation of the order under current law is a misdemeanor. The legislature in the past couple of years raised the maximum fine for a Class A misdemeanor from $5,000 to $10,000. So this just conforms the warning to what the law is. And this amendment does the same thing, conforming the law to another change in protective orders for stalking and sexual assault that aren't necessarily domestic violence.
So it's a conforming amendment.
Yes.
That they found another section of law, which is the 1865-865, that would conform with this 66-130. So, okay, I got it. All right.
Remove my objection.
All right, any objection?
Was that 12?
Amendment number 12. That brings us to amendment number 15, dot 15, which would be amendment number 13. Let me take a brief of these for everybody. So, my apologies. I shouldn't be in such a hurry. This is amendment number U.15, which is amendment number 13. Did you object?
Object.
And Annie, why don't you go ahead and describe this language? This deals with the reporting of the court on the judges, right?
Yes, and yeah, and maybe Ms. Mead could just explain. We have concerns about this one, but she should be able to explain.
All right, I'll give you your best shot. Now, Ms. Mead, why don't you go ahead and identify yourself and give us your.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. And the language of this amendment would be helpful for the court system and is considered an improvement over the language in the current CS because it allows the Judicial Council to avoid reporting information it may receive that that turns out not to be true or that the council investigates and concludes is not substantiated. And in this area of whether the judge considered the victim, it's a subjective area, and victims sometimes believe that the judge should be doing more or less of a sentence in accordance with the victim's wishes. So this gives the council some discretion to avoid reporting things that it finds out are not substantiated, but at the same time it does allow the council to publicize information about a judge if in fact there are substantiated reports that the judge is not considering victims appropriately at sentencing. And it also raises or heightens awareness among judges that the victim information at sentencing is important. And so it serves to stress that for judges and for the public and for the council. But it does not, it takes away some of the risk in the other language that there could be misleading or inaccurate information publicized about a judge who's really doing everything right. And therefore, that information would be unfair. So that's the reason for this amendment.
And we'd like to make it as clear as possible, but it seemed to me, Annie, that the A5 language, 55025, has three criteria. Can those be clearly identified? And if I may, I'll just read it so that those listening in, it was 1255025, I'm sorry, and it's A5. And in the case of a conviction for a felony offense, information assessing A, the financial, emotional, and medical effects of the offense of the victim, B, the need for the victim for restitution, and C, any other information required by the court. And so you start getting pretty ambiguous at that point. But what the reporting requirement that you put in was, did they consider that? And if I understand that was what you want to do, is to make sure that they are considering that as far as the victims under this section.
Well, that you're absolutely correct. We want to make sure that judges are considering these factors that are listed in 1255025A5. We certainly have no interest in requiring the Judicial Council to publish information that's inaccurate or unsubstantiated or just wrong. Mm-hmm. What we did want is to require that the Judicial Council report the information that is accurate, that they have found to be accurate about a judge and whether or not he or she follows the law in terms of considering the rights or the harm to victims in imposing sentence. And what I'm concerned about is when it says may include the judge's consideration of victims, I'm not sure that's strong enough to get them to do that.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For Nancy, it seemed to me like what was being proposed was somewhat unworkable. Is that for you, for the court system? Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, probably more accurately for the Judicial Council. Right. If we had to provide that, it would have been difficult for both of our organizations to do that.
And I'll just say, Mr. Chair, I understand where the administration is going with this. I think it's laudable. I just think it's unworkable what they've proposed. So I think it's a reasonable amendment. I'll just ask you. Forget it. That's just my position on it.
So the new language, if we accept this amendment, would be the information may include the judge's consideration of victims when imposing sentence on persons convicted of felony offenses where the offenses involved victims. What are some of the things that would be hard for you to glean from this, Annie, for as far as any reporting requirements?
Well, the problem is that it says the information that may include this, the evaluation may include this information. But, you know, right now it may include that information. I don't know that it makes any changes to what is current law. You know, and I'd be happy to work on this over the weekend with Ms. Mead, and if we're going to go till Monday anyway, to see if we can come to something that would, you know, we want the evaluation to include information about judges and whether they are focusing or doing what the law, what you have required them to do in Title 12, and that is to
just take care. Asking you out loud, if we do take this language and we make it directive, shall include judges' consideration of victims. If it was mandatory,
uh-huh.
and we were still taking consideration of the victims when imposing sentences, would that still be just as ambiguous as the original language?
If we say the information shall include the judge's consideration,
right.
with the rest of the language of this amendment,
right?
Yeah, that would be good. If you took out may and put shall.
Because, I mean, it's pretty much going to be based on the same requirements of 1255-25 anyway, I would think.
Uh-huh.
Because that's going to be the information required on imposing sentence. If there's going to be an accountability to the judges with regard to victims when imposing sentences, that may be one way of looking at it. I'm open to discussion on this, to set it aside for the weekend, to think it over. We will have a CS coming to us based on everything else we've done, and we could leave this as an open amendment if you wish.
May I add one point, yes. Mr. Chairman? The may serves a few purposes there, but one of them is, for example, some of our judges don't do felony sentencing, so it gives a little bit of discretion for if there's a problem with victims in felony sentencing, it would be reported. But if it's not applicable to a certain judge, or if there's not, that there wouldn't be a more or less pro forma sentence, and every bit of every information that's made available that there were no problems. So that's just one consideration. But again, I can work with Ms.
And I see that's why you put the word victims in there, because if it was just felony offenses, that may not always apply to what the reporting requirements are. But they did say specifically under 025A5, which did deal with victims. Mm-hmm. All right.
What I'm trying to say is some judges just do civil cases. Mm-hmm. So they would have
nothing. Well, we've gone 15 minutes over, so I'm willing to set this amendment aside. So I'll withdraw the amendment at this point, and it will have to be made again. If there's going to be a change, otherwise it will show up in the CS as the original language, and so if it's going to change, it needs to change. All right. With that, Annie, we just got one called AM.2 dealing with an indirect court rule amendment. Is that something that we should deal with today? Can you explain it rapidly?
Yes, I can. And that was something actually that was raised in the House. And when we went back and looked at it, the changes in the Rape Shield statute for the time limits and the sexual conduct of the victim after the alleged offense, they would affect Evidence Rule 404A. So it's important that we note that it's it affects the provisions of a court rule.
Any questions on that? I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll move it as it's the kind of the new Amendment 13, right? My record keeper? All right, this is a 14. It'll be a 14. Amendment number 14. I'll move Amendment number 14, which is AM/2.
And I'll object for discussion.
Any discussion on it? You want to go through it? This is more conforming, I think.
Yeah, it's just a housekeeping provision. You've already voted it to, the provision in, let's see, it's section 15 on page 9, the Rape Shield provision that applies the protection to complaining witnesses to conduct after the alleged offense and puts the 5-day, the requirement of raising it 5 days before trial or later for good cause, or for information learned after the deadline. It just notes that this language would have the effect of changing Evidence Rule 404A and because of the time limits.
And we did put enough flexibility in there, if I remember correctly, Senator Wilkins.
Yeah, and I just want to make clear for the record that this is taking into consideration the amendments that we passed, adding the exceptions for good cause.
Yes, yes, it does.
All right. Any objection to Amendment Number 14?
I remove my objection.
All right. No objection to Amendment 14. It passes. That leaves us with one lingering question, actually several, but one for sure on Amendment Number 13. So I'm going to order a CS based on the amendments today, and if we get it Monday, fine. If not, we'll deal with it Tuesday. All right.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You are adjourned.